articles come out about him being a saint and him selling miracles and the 12 people he trained being apostles of wheat, that's where things have gone wrong. They've forgotten that science is supposed to be about science. And today that cancer train from Punjab is a result of the chemicals that came from the war into agriculture and into our food systems and our bodies. There is a continuum between wars we see as wars, like what's happening in Syria right now, but also the wars against the planet and the wars against people. Corporations are behind all of this. And I see, as Wall Street makes the world's economies collapse, the only economy left is war.
There was an interesting sign that flooded Wall Street yesterday, Winona. It said, "Tear down that Wall Street," referring, of course, to Reagan's famous line about the Berlin Wall. But you are going to be at the UN Climate Summit today, Winona. Where will you be? Why are you going?
I'm going to be with the indigenous people. It's a really historic time for us. I mean, the fact is that, you know, I was at the first UN conference on indigenous people in 1977, and yesterday the Tata Daho was at the General Assembly. And then today there will be indigenous people addressing. And I think that just those moments that indigenous people as part of our work, you know, being there is important. I'm going to be at the climate summit that is on the side, you know, with indigenous people. But it is an important time for indigenous people. We have no recourse in the United States or in Canada and many of these countries under our law. That's why we've been fighting for some international recognition of our rights as peoples, as indigenous peoples. But, you know, these issues are very systemic. They affect all kinds of people, the issues of climate change and, you know, climate disaster. That is across the board.
We're going to continue this discussion right after the show, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. Winona LaDuke, I want to thank you for being with us. Native American leader, writer, Desmond Desa, thank you so much for joining us. South African environmentalist based in Durban, winner of the 2014 Goldman Prize, and Vandana Shiva, Indian environmental leader, feminist, and author. That does it for the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Berker, Nepal, Sarah Maté, Nermin Sheikh, Dina Guzder, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:02. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon, committed to helping our community's most vulnerable people for over 100 years and to giving them a hand up rather than a hand out. More information is available on the web at voaor.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a talk by Jeff Clements, "Corporations Are Not People," which takes place at the First Unitarian Church in Portland on Friday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. Jeff Clements is founder of Free Speech for People and author of the book Corporations Are Not People. Again, that's Jeff Clements, Friday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a talk by Jeff Clements, "Corporations Are Not People," which takes place at the First Unitarian Church in Portland on Friday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. Jeff Clements is founder of Free Speech for People and author of the book Corporations Are Not People. Again, that's Jeff Clements, Friday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Ghosts of Tonkin on Saturday, September 27th at 7:30 p.m. This award-winning play dramatizes the behind-the-scenes story of how public officials brought about one of the most devastating chapters in the history of the United States, the Vietnam War, and of Oregon Senator Wayne Morse, one of only two congressmen to vote against the Tonkin Resolution. There will be a discussion following the play, moderated by KBOO's Joanne Hardesty, and includes playwright Steve Lyons and others. Again, that's The Ghosts of Tonkin, Saturday, September 27th at Lincoln Hall on the Portland State University campus, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on The Ghosts of Tonkin can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Forest Grove is the first in the state to approve recreational marijuana tax.
A public hearing for the Portland Master Plan is underway, including the potential expansion of the Port of Portland on West Hayden Island.
Chelsea Manning plans to sue the federal government for discrimination.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014. I'm Jenka Soderberg.
And I'm Emily Young. On November 4th, Oregonians will be able to vote on the legalization of marijuana in the whole state. But Forest Grove City Council approved a 10% tax on recreational marijuana and marijuana-infused products Monday, allowing recreational pot smokers to use legally. The approved tax on marijuana comes after criticism from medical marijuana advocates who resisted against the taxing of medical marijuana. Mayor Peter Truax made the decision to make last-minute provisions to the ordinance on Monday, stating that it was, quote, a mistake, unquote. The ordinance is now in effect as of October 22nd in the city of Forest Grove.
If you've ever shopped for soap in a natural food store, you've probably seen the Dr. Bronner's soap with the crazy labels covered in tiny print. Well, there really was a Dr. Bronner. He came to the U.S. in 1929 from Germany. His grandson and current president of the company, David Bronner, is a Harvard grad who prides himself on understanding the science underlying genetically modified foods and seeds. He's as unconventional as his grandfather. Bronner has so far donated hundreds of thousands of dollars in support of Oregon's Measure 92, making him the largest donor. That measure, if passed, would make Oregon one of the first states in the nation to require the labeling of genetically modified foods, following Vermont. Last year, his company donated $1.8 million in Washington's narrowly defeated effort to label GMOs and also donated to California's effort. With a degree in biology, Bronner objects to the genetically modified seeds and how they adversely affect the soil and crops, saying it's not improving crop yield and food production, but rather creating unsustainable agriculture methods that rely on the increasing use of pesticides. Bronner hopes that eventually, when enough states start requiring GMO labeling, beginning with Oregon's Measure 92, it will become a national standard.
Yesterday, Monday, September 22nd, thousands took to the streets of New York City for a protest dubbed Flood Wall Street. At around 7 p.m., a reported 104 protesters who refused to disperse from the intersection of Broadway and Wall Street were handcuffed and loaded in police vans one by one. In contrast to Mayor Bloomberg's confrontational and controversial police treatment of Occupy protesters in 2012, it appeared that the new mayor, de Blasio's police force, was under orders to show restraint. The day included hours of speeches and music in Battery Park before marchers headed toward Wall Street in time for the 4 p.m. closing bell. It was at this point that police tear gassed a number of protesters in the vicinity of their barricades. A sit-in at the intersection of Wall Street and Broadway ensued. The protest was timed ahead of today's United Nations Climate Summit, the first occasion since the failed 2009 meeting in Copenhagen that world leaders have come together on the issue of climate change. In anticipation of this high-powered profile meeting, protesters all over the world took to the streets Sunday for the People's Climate March. In New York alone, the event garnered an estimated 400,000 attendees. However, for many activists and citizens of conscience, the overall message and political sponsors of the march were too soft on the financial giants underpinning our carbon-dependent status quo. Monday's Flood Wall Street action was explicitly anti-capitalist, According to Sandra Nurse, one of the organizers, quote, the climate crisis is not just a narrow environmental problem of resources or jobs in need of better management. It is the supreme symptom of a political and economic system that is bankrupt to its core, unquote. Coordinated by many who participated in Occupy Wall Street, activists observed that the turnout for Flood Wall Street stands as proof that the movement is still going strong.
This past Saturday in Tampa, Florida, a boat from the Israeli shipping company Zim was met by Block the Boat activists. Inspired by recent actions in Seattle, Tacoma, and Los Angeles, this was the third time that Tampa residents have attempted to block the unloading of a Zim ship. Although the Zim ship Alabama was eventually unloaded, activists once again succeeded in drawing attention to their critique of the Israeli treatment of Palestinians and U.S. complicity in the occupation. The Block the Boat movement acts in response to a 2005 call from Palestinian civil society to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel until the occupation of Palestine is brought to an end. The international movement is now commonly referred to by its acronym, BDS. In addition to the BDS movement, Block the Boat endorsers include the International Solidarity Movement, International Women's Peace Service in Palestine, Labor for Palestine, Fight for 15 Florida, Jewish Voice for Peace, and Tampa Food Not Bombs.
A public hearing is currently underway in Portland regarding the 20-year comprehensive master plan for the city of Portland. The hearing begins at 5 p.m. and is being held at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue. Part of the hearing will address the future of West Hayden Island, which is currently a wild area considered by Portland Audubon Society and other groups working hard to protect it from a planned expansion of the Port of Portland. They say that West Hayden Island is one of Portland's most important natural areas, providing wildlife habitat for many rapidly disappearing native species of birds. That hearing again is tonight, beginning at 5 p.m. at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland.
The memorial for the unarmed teenager Michael Brown, who was gunned down and murdered by police officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, was burned overnight during a fire likely sparked by candles, police said. But upset residents said they thought that someone set the fire after they smelled gasoline in the area. Sightings of theft from the memorial have also been reported. Residents in the area have been keeping close watch for the memorial. The residents that live in the area where Mike Brown was shot have since helped to put up a new memorial that is currently still being constructed.
A coalition of 44 media groups organized by the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press is calling on the U.S. Justice Department to include police interaction with the media in its investigation of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri last month. The groups say that news coverage of events like the situation in Ferguson must be uncensored and not manipulated by law enforcement. The open letter comes after the syllabus for a police class called How to Win the Media in St. Louis County was leaked. The syllabus described techniques for police to use to turn the public perception against the victim by using racial bias and stereotypes and feeding those to a compliant media. A lawyer who deals with issues of police violence spoke about this class on Hard Knock Radio last night.
Let's just get your listeners aware of exactly how disingenuous and how disturbing this class that they're teaching in St. Louis is. There's a couple of bullet points about what they're going to teach. One is how to feed the animals. Now, who the hell are the animals? Are the animals those of us who protest? Are the animals the public? I mean, this is the sort of disparaging way that law enforcement has come to look at people.
So, right, this is actually on the official invitation for the class to the police.
Exactly.
Go ahead, read the
article. Right,
can I interject one thing really quickly? And this is a PDF that is on St. Louis County's website. From their website.
This is on taxpayer website, so people are being referred to as animals. What's the other point you wanted
That's
to make,
right. John? Well, the other point is really important, Davey. We've had 64 deaths in Sonoma County since 2000. That's when the Department of Justice came here and lambasted law enforcement for a pattern and practice of excessive use of force. Since that time, we've had 64 deaths. Now, one of the problems is They have unlimited resources. We need to jump into every one of those cases, and we need to delve into the facts. We need a lot more activists, you know, law students and paralegals and community people. You know, one of the cases I'm involved in, there was an 11-hour siege on a family's home by 50 SWAT officers using 100 CS grenades, a Bearcat that smashed down the front door, and, you know, they gassed the father of two young children until he, you know, basically was asphyxiated, and they claim he shot himself. Well, once we went into delving into the facts in that case, they were very different. The neighbors painted a completely different story of what had transpired, but the police version was the first version quoted. So on our side, we've got to get to be as good as they are. We should be teaching our own classes in people's journalists like you, Davies, like at KPFA, where we have our own voice, so that immediately we're telling the truth. Now, I'd like to ask the sister from Ferguson, I'm not even clear. Was that video of Michael Brown? Did he go into that store? You know what I mean? In other words, they've confused and muddied the waters. We need, you know, we on our side need to develop a more transparent media response. And if it's building our own media outlets and our own networks nationally, you know, from Ferguson, we were chanting in Half Moon Bay. That's a little farm worker town and tourist town on Highway 1 in sort of the beautiful Big Sur coastline. We were chanting from Half Moon Bay to Ferguson, same struggle, same fight. And that's got to be our motto, you know, whether it's one shooting or two shootings or three shootings. You know, I'd like to see us be able to respond nationally as quickly as they do with our, you know, honest version, because truth is almost inevitably on our side.
The groups filing the petition to the Department of Justice are demanding that the federal investigation of the Ferguson Police Department include the police interaction with the media.
Pennsylvania police are still searching for a so-called survivalist accused of ambushing a state police housing compound on September 12th. 31-year-old Eric Matthew Freen is accused of killing state trooper Byron Dixon and wounding another state trooper. Freen is alleged to have used high-power rifle shooting equipment from inside the woods not far from the location of the compound. The attack is said to have been aimed at law enforcement in general, rather than at the individuals that were shot. Freen is known to be a strong anti-government survivalist, but no prior cases of attacks on police have been reported. Since the 10-day manhunt began, residents in the surrounding area where the shooting took place have been unable to get back into their homes due to the heavy police activity in the Pocono Mountains. No word on any other leads on where Freen could possibly have gone.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for a weekly segment on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
You're listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Once upon a time, beginning after the American Revolution, people had a very different attitude about for-profit business corporations. The general belief at the time was that each individual business corporation should serve the common good, should exist to provide for one specific social need, and should cause no harm. People also understood that corporations were not created to interfere in the political process or to participate in the civic life of a community. The earliest business corporations built bridges, roads, and canals, milled grain and cotton, and ran banks. You might be surprised about this history, but it's really not that surprising when you consider that the early colonists in this country already had a very bad taste in their mouths when they thought about corporations, because our original 13 colonies were themselves business corporations created by kings and queens across the Atlantic Ocean. For example, the state of Delaware, as we know it today, was originally known as the Delaware Company. The state of Massachusetts was originally the Massachusetts Bay Company, and so on. Every one of the founding 13 states had at one time been a crown corporation chartered by a monarch. The American Revolution was, to a large degree, an anti-corporate rule revolution. The colonists revolted against the monarch's corporations. We didn't learn this in school, but it's true. And this is why, after the American Revolution, the early colonists chose to fundamentally redefine and redesign the business corporation so that it could never again oppress them. State legislatures were given the job of deciding which new business corporations would be given the privilege to exist. Investors would come to their respective state legislatures with a proposal for a specific new corporation, and the legislature would then write a charter for that new corporation. A corporate charter is what we now refer to as the Articles of Incorporation. The charter was the defining document. It laid out what the corporation was allowed to do, what it was required to do, and what it was forbidden to do. The rules were very strict, and if they were broken, the state legislature would commonly respond by revoking the charter, which also allowed it to seize the corporate assets and sometimes even to imprison the directors. So let's not get too depressed about what we the people can do when our business corporations cause serious harm to our communities and to nature. Because it's American as apple pie for us to respond by revoking that corporation's charter, which automatically dissolves the company. The only problem is that we the people have mostly forgotten our history, and we don't even know that we have the right to do this. But there's more. Here's a list of the kinds of rules that corporate charters used to include after the American Revolution. And as I read this list, imagine how useful these rules would be to put back into law today. A corporate charter could be revoked at any time and for any reason by a state legislature. Directors and stockholders would be held fully liable for all harms and debts. There would be no limited liability protection. A unanimous vote from the stockholders was required to approve a major change in corporate policy. All stockholders had to live in the state where the corporation was chartered. Corporations were usually chartered for 10 to 30 years. And then their charter was revoked unless it was renewed by the state legislature. Corporations were not allowed to own or merge with other corporations. Corporations were prohibited from donating money to candidates or elected officials in government. Corporations were prohibited from donating to charitable or civic organizations. Corporate financial records were all considered public information. It's American as apple pie, we the people having full political control over our business corporations. It's not socialism. It's not communism. This is our own revolutionary history. And we can't afford to not know this history because this is exactly the sort of rulemaking that we so desperately need today in this country as giant corporations run roughshod over our political institutions. The first step towards bringing corporations back to being our servants and not our masters is to end their so-called constitutional rights, which is what we in the community rights movement are working towards across the country. I invite you to join us. You've been listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Mohammed Ismail, an engineer in Gaza who's trying to build a desalination plant for the people of Gaza. This will be followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Cameron Cood and Lynette McFadden to talk about the upcoming event Buy Visibility Day. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock guest is radio programmer and media justice advocate Bob Law to talk about the state of black media. Tomorrow's weather will be rain with a high of 72 degrees, an evening low of 59 degrees. It's cooling off, folks. Today in history, in 1806, the Lewis and Clark expedition returned to St. Louis, Missouri, more than 2 years after setting out for the Pacific Northwest. And on September 23, 1939, the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, passed away in London at the age of 83. The quote of the day is by the late saxophone great John Coltrane, who will be featured at Clinton Street Theater tonight at 7 p.m. The film showing tonight is a benefit for KBOO Radio, a great way to get out of the rain for a couple of hours. The great John Coltrane once said, quote, "I've found you've got to look back at the old things and see them in a new light."
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The giants of food manufacturing are very concerned about you. They fear you could come down with a terrible plague called consumer confusion, and these selfless corporate entities are going all out to save you from it. The altruistic corporations say that this plague emanates from the grimy and untrustworthy grassroots. Indeed, several states intend to require food manufacturers that put genetically modified organisms in their products to include that information on their labels. Labeling advocates note that since millions of consumers don't want their families eating foods with altered DNA, putting the phrase "contains GMO ingredients" on the packages will let every shopper decide whether to buy that product or not. It seems both simple and honest. "No way," shout lobbyists for the food adulterators. One, they claim that such efforts would create a patchwork of state labeling laws, inflicting confusion on consumers. Also, they say the labels might further spread confusion by implying that the genetically tampered ingredients are, well, tampered with by corporate engineers. So, the benevolent corporations are lobbying Congress to save you from confusion by autocratically preempting the state's authority to write consumer protection laws. Instead, the industry demands that a federal agency be directed to create a national labeling program that would take precedence over all state laws. Not that the national GMO label would be mandatory. No, no, it would be voluntary, so each corporation could decide for itself whether to tell consumers what's in their food. This is Jim Hightower saying, "I was born at night, but it wasn't last night." No consumer is so confused as to believe that even a single GMO user would, quote, volunteer to be honest with us. Anything less than mandatory GMO labeling is nothing but flagrant consumer fraud.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We believe that this is the largest back pay case in the history of the National Labor Relations Board, conservatively tens of millions of dollars in back pay and for people to be made whole for the loss of benefits and some of the conditions that were contained in their union contracts. People should think long and hard about whether the company that claims to be the leader in providing news is a good leader when it comes to being a corporate citizen. Their actions clearly state otherwise.
NABIT CWA Union President Jim Joyce talking about CNN. CNN is appealing an NLRB ruling ordering the rehiring of 100 union workers and compensating about 200 others for back pay and lost union contract benefits dating back 11 years. The NLRB found CNN's anti-union actions to be illegal and also ordered CNN to begin bargaining with NABIT on a new labor contract. CNN is appealing the decision in federal appeals court.
The National Labor Relations Board will go to court to have their decision enforced, and we're optimistic that we'll continue to have the outcomes that we've had in the two previous forums. But the people that are really suffering here are the 300 or so workers that had their lives upended by CNN's actions back in 2003 in Washington and early 2004 in New York City.
Joyce says this case screams out for meaningful labor law reform to get faster judgments for workers. He says NABIT CWA will be picketing in front of CNN headquarters Wednesday in Washington, D.C., and Friday in New York. The Golden Gate Bridge Labor Coalition says another strike by one of its 13-member unions is possible soon if no new labor agreement is reached with the bridge district. A one-day machinist strike that did not disrupt commuters on the bridge has already happened. The Labor Coalition says its members are 12% behind the expensive cost of living in the Bay Area, and they want to see real raises to catch them up. They also say the bridge management wants to significantly increase the cost of health care for the workers. The next strike at the bridge, the unions say, could affect commuters who use the bridge and nearby public transit. At New York's JFK Airport, 32 BJSEIU workers are fighting back against what they say is a relentless anti-union campaign by their bosses. The workers say more actions will happen if management doesn't stop harassing and spying on pro-union workers. SEIU says that a 68-year-old skycap, Jeffrey Benjamin, was sent home from work after Allstate maintenance supervisors saw him wearing a 32 BJSEIU union button. Benjamin told New York's Labor Press that they told him management didn't want to see any more 32 BJ buttons. Low-wage workers at the airport decided back in May to have 32 BJSEIU be their union, but the bosses are refusing to bargain with the workers on a new labor contract. About 60 JFK airport workers staged a one-day unfair labor practices strike earlier this month. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now we turn to locally produced Native news.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, kills two civilians and kidnap eight others.
Of course, excuse that. And now we turn to National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The United Nations General Assembly adopted an agreement called the Outcome Document Monday that provides measures to implement the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The declaration was adopted in 2007. Monday's move happened during the first ever World Conference on Indigenous Peoples being held in New York City. The outcome document focuses on four priorities: to set up a body to monitor the implementation of the declaration, to establish a permanent status for Indigenous governments at the UN, prevent violence against Indigenous women, and protect sacred sites. Robert Coulter, executive director of the Indian Law Resource Center, says Indigenous people, including from tribes in the U.S., participated in creating the document.
It was a wonderful moment. The hundreds of Indigenous participants who were in the General Assembly Hall rose to their feet and applauded, celebrated, and it was a very, very good moment because of what the Indigenous nations and peoples have been able to achieve.
Coulter says details still need to be worked out. The Indigenous conference wraps up today. Native people are also in New York this week participating in events to address climate change as world leaders meet at the UN for a climate summit. Events this week included a march and lectures. Indigenous activists are voicing concerns about fracking, uranium mining, and protecting natural resources. Tribal leaders are now looking to the Obama administration to take action in the U.S. British Columbia's political leaders recently sat down with First Nations for an all-chiefs meeting. It's the first meeting since the Supreme Court of Canada upheld a BC First Nations right to more than 400,000 acres of land in the province. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
It was the first time ever British Columbia Premier Christy Clark and her cabinet sat down for talks with all 203 of BC's First Nations. And among her first actions was to formally acknowledge Aboriginal title. She could hardly do otherwise in the wake of a high court ruling which expanded and clarified that title.
My position on that hasn't changed. I want to get a negotiated agreement. I intend to get one. And I think as long as we keep our eyes focused on that goal, it will remain within our reach. The minute we take our eyes off that goal, I think it will begin to elude us.
Until now, Clark has shown little inclination to tackle the 150-year-old land question. The unprecedented meeting took more than 2 years to organize, but not nearly as much as what went into winning the case before the country's highest court. Ed John is the Grand Chief of the First Nations Summit.
That's a tremendous amount of resources, tremendous amount of cost, tremendous amount of time of our elders. That's been a part of this long and difficult struggle. Now we're at a place where the courts have said, these people are right.
John says First Nations communities are now in a better position to benefit and manage resource development. There was, however, no major breakthrough at the summit. Many elders were hoping for at least a joint statement on title recognition and revenue sharing. Clark did offer some progress on certain economic projects, but she sidestepped the issues of rights and reconciliation. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Justice Department announced Monday more than $87 million in grants will address tribal law enforcement and crime prevention efforts. Nine areas are being focused on, including justice systems planning, substance abuse, and youth programs. 169 tribal grants were awarded nationally. The American Indian Alaska Native Tourism Association honored some of the best Indian country destinations during an awards ceremony last week in Louisiana. The 2014 awards went to the Alaska Tourism Corporation, Alaska Native Voices in Huna, and the best tribal destination to Chickasaw Country in Oklahoma. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National...
And that was National Native News. Whistleblower Chelsea Manning, formerly known as Bradley Manning, is suing the U.S. federal government to receive appropriate medical care for the gender disorder which was diagnosed in 2010. Chelsea Manning is currently serving a 35-year sentence for her role in the leaking of classified documents to WikiLeaks after she was convicted for that on July 30, 2013. Currently, Chelsea is suing to receive hormone therapy, permission to follow female standards, and access to a doctor trained to deal with her condition. She's also seeking appropriate psychological therapy to help with her condition. The federal government has been denying Chelsea Manning access to medical treatment for her condition, gender dysphoria. Though the government has provided Chelsea with female-identified clothing, her request for medical treatment for her female identity has been denied. Chelsea has also requested to be transferred to a civilian population prison. This request has also been denied by Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Chelsea Manning could become eligible for parole in 2021.
The U.S. military carried out a number of airstrikes in Syria last night against alleged members of the right-wing group calling itself the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. A military spokesperson reports hitting 14 different places in Syria last night using a variety of fighter jets, bombers, drones, and sea-launched missiles. In addition to the homes of ISIS fighters, the airstrikes also targeted a group of former al-Qaeda fighters who have formed an organization called Khorasan. The bombing caused a mass exodus of Syrian refugees across the border with Turkey, where they clashed with Turkish police who had tried to force the refugees back.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, kills two civilians and kidnap eight others. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Two Palestinian men were killed by invading Israeli soldiers Tuesday at dawn at the center of Hebron City in the southern West Bank. According to the Israeli army, Marwan al-Kawasma and Amir Abu Ayesha were surrounded at a home in Hebron city center and were killed after a short gunfight with the Israeli troops. The army used a military bulldozer to destroy parts of the building. Residents said that troops set fire to the building after taking the two bodies and left the area. Scores of youth clashed with the invading forces for several hours. Palestinian firefighters and medics rushed to the scene and put off the fire. Many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, and around 10 civilians were injured by Israeli soldiers' rubber-coated steel bullets, local sources reported. On Tuesday midday, the Israeli army handed over the two bodies and were laid to rest during a funeral in Hebron City. Local sources said that hundreds took part in the funeral. The Israeli state accused Al-Kawasmi and Abu Ayesha of killing the three Israeli settlers near Hebron in June. The Israeli army and government have not provided any evidence that both Al-Kawasmi and Abu Ayesha or any Palestinians involved in the killing of the three settlers. Shortly after the settlers went missing, the Israeli army conducted a large-scale search campaign in Hebron City and kidnapped more than 700 Palestinians. Moreover, a week after the remains of the three settlers were found, an Israeli radical group kidnapped a Palestinian teenager from Jerusalem and killed him. Later on Tuesday morning, the Israeli army conducted invasions at a number of West Bank communities, searched and ransacked homes, and kidnapped 8 men. Troops also clashed with local youth. No injuries were reported. Local sources reported that Israeli troops searched and ransacked homes in Nablus and Jenin cities in the north of the West Bank, in addition to the cities of Hebron and Bethlehem in the southern West Bank. 2 men were taken when troops searched homes in Jenin City. 2 more civilians were kidnapped after troops searched their homes in Al-Arub refugee camp near Hebron. 4 civilians were taken by soldiers during home searches in Bethlehem City, local sources reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, September 23rd, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sarah Swetsoff and Mohammed Ismail. The producer and engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to, you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, the guests are grassroots women activists from the U.S., Nigeria, and Tibet. They'll talk about the work they do on the ground to dismantle oppression, empower women, and shift the paradigm. At 11 on the Recovery Zone, biologist David George Haskell discusses his book, The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. At 11:30, we hear from Rebecca Hunt, Marilyn Keller, and Skeeter Green about My Walk Has Never Been Average, Stories of Black Tradeswomen. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for an interview with an engineer in Gaza who is working to create a desalination plant there in the Gaza Strip.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Mohammed Ismail in Gaza, who is working to build a desalination plant in Gaza. Mohammed, can you tell us a little bit about the project?
Yes, thank you for calling me. I'm Mohammed Ismail from Gaza, 24 years old, and industrial engineer. I was working with two other engineers in this project of the desalination plant, the RO desalination plant, which is intended to be built to partially solve the problem and the crisis of the water in Gaza. First of all, the project is aiming to produce about 100,000 liters per day of desalinated water, which is going to be seeming free of charge to reach the people who just got harmed by the Israeli assassination during the war in Gaza. So the people who just left their houses and just are living in camps are the target of this project, who are going to be served by this plant.
And what is the need for desalination in Gaza? I understand that there are a lot of issues with the water, even preceding the Israeli attack that began in July.
Yes, the water crisis in Gaza isn't new. The UN just said that after 2015, there will be no available water to drink in Gaza, because the only source of the water is the aquifers that are going to be empty in the two next years. Also, the other sources are prevented to be useful to the people of Gaza because of the occupation, who is getting the water from it. So that's it, because you cannot reach all of your aquifers, also your ground walls. That's because you cannot build your desalination plant, your massive desalination plant, because there is a threat of bombing it. So because of all of this, you cannot really solve the problem of the water in Gaza. So I think we are going partially solve for some people, not for all of the Gazans, because we just work individually by ourselves. And we are not an organization, we are not a firm, and we are not aiming to build a massive one. So I wish that there will be real tactics which are going to really solve the problem, not partially.
So you are now trying to raise $60,000. It doesn't seem like a lot here in the U.S., but that will be enough to build this desalination plant that you're talking about?
Yes, about the 100 cube per day output. It is enough, because the land which is gonna host this plant is given by one of our mates, so there will be no land rent. Also, the fees of the design and the working group are us. The three of us are gonna work on this plant, so there will be no fees to anyone or any manpower. So because of this, I think, yes, it is, and we just studied it. It is feasible to start such a project in and this amount of money. But actually, we expect we are not going to reach this number. So because of that, we just wrote an attention that we if we just did not reach 40% of the target, we are going to use this this money, this contributions to study on such on such a project. We are going to study the HD method, not the RO method of the desalination. So
can you explain the difference between the HD and the RO method of desalination? RO, I understand, is reverse osmosis. And what's the what's the other the ED method?
The humidification and the dehumidification of water. This is a new approach in desalination. So an engineer, a structural engineer living in the U.S., just suggested that to us, that we are, you are going to study. Why not study another method? Because the RO has a lot of studies. Also, it is common and it's popular. What about another way? You just study something else because this might be more efficient, and that's why we are going to study such things.
And how will the desalination plant be powered?
First of all, we are going to power it electrically because now we are going to just to start such a project and just to start to produce water and desalinated water, but in the next phases, after gaining much feed, we are going to save these feed to improve the desalination plant, which is going to be a powered solar. We are going to use the solar power, solar energy, to power the plant, but in the next phases, not now, because now we are aiming to quickly start this project and to quickly solve the problem with the harm people who are now only depending on the water which is given by the aid organizations.
And you talked about the water crisis in Gaza, the depleting aquifers, the Israeli military control of much of the water. But also it seems that the water infrastructure that does exist in Gaza was targeted in the 50-day-long Israeli bombardment. Can you talk about some of the targeting of the water infrastructure in Gaza?
Yes, many of aquifers, many of desalination plants were hit. The desalination plants, what I'm talking about, are referring to the municipalities of Gaza City and the other cities in Gaza Strip. So also many main pipes were targeted. They need to fix all of almost about $3 billion, I think, $3 billion to they have to spend this amount of money to solve the problem of the infrastructure and the water aquifers, the water pipelines, which were bombed by the Israeli attack the last 2 months.
And people can find a full map of that destruction of the water infrastructure, including both the sewage and the water pipelines and treatment plants at ewash.org. That's ewash.org. Now, Mohammed, your project is a small drop in the bucket as compared to that $3 billion that's needed. How many other projects like yours are underway? Will there be enough projects to...
There will be a massive desalination plant, which is going to be performed by the UNICEF. But there are many problems with this project because of the Israeli companies who are aiming to get a chance of a profitable chance with this massive desalination plant. So the contractors here in Gaza are refusing dealing with the UNICEF because of this Israeli companies. And they are asking the UNICEF not to deal with any Israeli company because we are not accepting that Israel destroy and rebuild anything here in Gaza. They have to pay their fault not by paying money and rebuilding. They have to stop destroying. That's what we are asking here in Gaza, not to destroy and rebuild. And to make it easy for Israel to redo anything like destruction of water aquifers, destruction of the infrastructure and the houses of civilians.
So there is a project being planned by UNICEF from the United Nations, but it's using Israeli companies as contractors?
Yes. There's a lot of speech about the Israeli contractors, but here in Gaza are refusing to deal with this project because of this. Yes, but till now there's not any action. Only on media we are reading about this project.
And I would assume that the reason that people in Gaza don't want to deal with the Israeli companies is that it's a call for boycott of Israeli companies in order to challenge their occupation. Is that part of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement?
Yes, of course, yes.
And
yes,
why is that a tactic that's being chosen by the people of Gaza to boycott Israeli companies? And how possible is it to actually boycott Israel, given that all of the products coming into Gaza essentially need to come through Israel?
Actually, we are in Gaza do not have the alternative because we only deal with the Israeli market. Now looking to alternatives, we don't have that industrial sector which can compete the Israeli products and the Israeli companies. So sometimes we had to deal with Israeli companies. Sometimes we had to buy Israeli products because there is no alternative. Now, just imagine that you are in the U.S., you can find a lot of alternatives of one product, but we sometimes do not have any alternative. We have to buy this product because we hope to gain its functionality and its uses and its usage. That's why we couldn't boycott and we couldn't sanction all the products and the companies. I'm working in a sanitary company, and we do buy a lot of products from Israeli companies because we do not have any other alternative.
But I would guess that you're asking people abroad who do have an alternative to boycott Israeli products?
Yes. They have the alternatives to boycott, and I just call them to do such a thing because this is the feasible way to stop Israel from its war crimes and its attacks on Gaza and the civilians, not only on Gaza, on the West Bank. And
how were you yourself impacted by the 50-day-long Israeli assault on Gaza?
Yes, personally. Yes, personally, I'm going to talk about myself. I just sat on my house all of the 51 days because we could not there were many attacks, there were many bombings. You are talking about 5 or 6 bombings in a moment. So this was too hard. Also, my neighbors here, three of my neighbor houses were bombed. So we just evacuated our house more than 5 or 6 times because we got warning messages that we are going to bomb near your house. We are going to bomb your neighbor house. So you have to evacuate sometimes at the midnight at 2 a.m. We just woke up and ran on the street to save ourselves. Only we do not have anything but ourselves, me, my wife, and my little Mary, which is 3 months old. And by the way, she lived more than the half of her age in the war. So you can imagine that.
You have a 3-month-old baby. I'm sure that must have been really difficult for you and your wife to have a 3-month-old baby in the midst of that. Must have been terrifying.
Yes, it was.
And did you have to go to a shelter?
Actually, no, because the shelters were full of the people who just left their houses during the ground invasion. The ground invasion were not affecting our area because we are living near the sea at the west of Gaza Strip, and the invasion was in the eastern Gaza Strip. So the shelters were almost used during the ground invasion, and we didn't had to go there.
And so let's just end with your Indiegogo campaign. You're trying to crowdfund this desalination plant in Gaza, and I assume that will be in Gaza City. Is that?